So maybe we'll do the meditation first, okay?
But before we do it, if you're here today and you did it those two times, were there any questions about it? Did it kind of, let's say a person who's never done it before, did you kind of get a vague idea of how the idea of it, the psychology of it, did it kind of work as an idea?
Yes.
It makes sense, sort of. Okay. All right. Yeah. And this really, we'll talk about emptiness after, and we will go into it. But this is, for sure, this is, they talk the three prerequisites. Renunciation, you've got to control your body and speech. You've got to understand your mind and get rid of delusions. You've got to want to get rid of suffering. Renunciation, which is junior school and high school. You've got to be motivated by bodhicitta. This is the main thing, actually, the main thing for the tantric practitioner. But you've got to have a view of emptiness. You've got to have the view. Because as I said yesterday, if you have a concrete sense of who you think you are, it's a joke to think you can turn into this, using the idea of turning into some green lady. It sounds hilarious, doesn't it? If you have a very vivid sense of me as a boy, for example, or me as this or whatever, it doesn't make sense. So to really make sense of these practices, we need to understand how there is no I from its own side, that the I that we think we are isn't the I we think we are. And because the I, therefore, is empty of inherent nature, inherent existence, existing from its own side, these words, which we'll talk about, therefore, because there is no I from its own side, I can become a Buddha. So forget even whether you think yourself a green lady, but the whole business, all the teachings on what they call Buddha nature, which we touched on briefly yesterday. As I said, ultimate Buddha nature actually refers to the emptiness of your own mind. So these words are abstract to us. We need to, as I said yesterday, we need to unpack them. But it takes time, of course. So the mind of emptiness is crucial to do this, to have these, and to, and of course, in the long term, for them to be effective. So let's just do, a bit of Tara again.
Oh yeah. Sorry, won't be long. Turn it off.
The clip.
Yeah, I've got it. So maybe you turn it off so it doesn't make an ugly noise. Can you turn it off? Just put it on mute so it doesn't make an ugly noise.
Okay. So get your body comfy, best you can. Like we talked before, the various points. If you can be in full lotus, great. If not, half lotus, great. If not, ordinary. If not, a chair. And if not that, lie down. Whatever you can do, best you can do. If not that, on your head. Whatever works, okay? I mean, I'm joking, but not joking. If there's an ideal scenario, then you do your best if you can't do it. Okay, so be just very natural about this. Just using, like I said yesterday, we think, oh, I can't visualize. Oh, I can't concentrate. Well, it's a load of rubbish. Of course we can. We do it all day. We're focusing single-pointedly on the new boyfriend in the middle of the 100,000 screaming football fans. Nothing will distract us. You're feeling angry with somebody. Like I said, you don't have to say, be quiet, I'm trying to focus on anger. You don't need to. You can do it beautifully. And we've got great visualization skills. We can, especially when you're in love, you can write these detailed, elaborate, fully developed movies in your mind. I remember. So don't think we can't visualize and don't think we can't focus. It's just that we're not used to visualizing, we're not used to focusing on virtue. It's just too boring for us, So we try. And remember the word to meditate. This is very sort of down to earth. The Tibetan word gom is translated as the verb to familiarize. Well, for the Buddha, the two things we have to familiarize our mind with, that which is true and that which is virtuous. That's what you're doing. We're familiarizing our mind. We'd call it learning. We'd call it practicing. When you practice piano, you're familiarizing your mind with music and your fingers get used to it. So here we're familiarizing our mind in this case, with imagining, as they say, the future result, we're bringing it into the present. The idealized form of a Buddha and the aspect of a Bodhisattva, in this case Tara, representing action, success, power, ability to benefit others, in this particular form, coming from Tibet, coming from India, and sort of buying into this meaning, you know. We're giving it this, we're giving her this meaning. And we're imagining her out there. We're imagining then the purifying that we do, and then we imagine bringing the energy into ourselves, and then we imagine being Tara, and then we imagine functioning as a Buddha, benefiting sentient beings. So we're using our creative imagination, which is all visualization is. And the better you get at it, of course, the more precise it can be, which is what we do slowly, slowly, you know. And remember, too, every thought counts. Every thought is a karma. Therefore, all these marvelous seeds we're planting, you know, how fantastic. Okay, so just imagine in front of us the energy, this the embodiment of these of all the qualities of an enlightened being. Infinite wisdom, infinite bliss, infinite joy, infinite compassion, infinite power. All these qualities, all the good qualities perfected. But in this form, you know, blissful green light body, this female form. Action energy, success, power. That's the shape she's taking. And imagine, think of it as a mirror image of your potential, you know. Like if you want to become the best footballer, you're going to put, you know, whoever it is these days on your wall. Every time you see the picture, it reminds you of what you can become. This is the whole approach here. Reminding you of what we can become. Bringing the future result into the present. It's a very optimistic way to meditate. Very empowering. So there's Tara, looking totally gorgeous. They say that all these images of the Buddha in this aspect, the Bodhisattva aspect, are in the prime of their youth, are all about 16 years old, looking gorgeous. And this is very much a part of Tantra, where we're meant to be energizing joy and bliss in the mind, as opposed to when we look at Shakyamuni Buddha, who represents the first stages of practice, he energizes the whole idea of subdued, discipline, control. That's what he represents. That image represents that part of the path. Well, these images, these meditations, these Bodhisattva aspect are representing, are meant to energize us. And we'll try and talk about this later. So there she is, totally gorgeous, completely blissful. Everything's made of light, dazzling, gorgeous, light, beautiful. Bodhisattva aspect, which is sort of like the Indian royal aspect, you know. Crown on her head, a bit like a tiara really, sort of on the front part. Then her hair is partially held up in a top knot, and you can see it in the statues and the pictures, kind of decorated with jewels. The rest of her hair down her back, black of course, being Indian. Then you imagine she's dressed very flimsily, you know, not many clothes at all, the top part's basically naked, these gorgeous breasts, very beautiful. And the bottom part, sort of, you see it on her legs, rainbow coloured, looks like sort of rainbow coloured trousers or something, you'll see it in the pictures. A little shawl around her shoulders, you know. And then decorated with beautiful jewels, you can imagine that. On her throat, upper arms, wrists, feet, ankles. Everything's radiant light, nothing substantial like a statue. And she's sitting on a multicolored lotus. And actually, I didn't say yesterday, but on the lotus you imagine two flat discs, like cushions, a white one, and one is the sun and one is the moon. And they represent like wisdom and compassion. And then this multicolored lotus she's sitting on. And then her left foot is drawn in like you would if you're sitting cross-legged. But her right leg is out, sitting, resting lightly on a little another multicolored lotus. And this is the action kind of pose, showing that she's willing to hop up to benefit sentient beings. That's the action energy. And her right hand is on her right knee and her palm is up in this gesture or mudra of giving. You know, it's like this very generous, open gesture. Her left thumb, her ring finger and thumb are holding the stem of a blue upala flower, which blooms at her right ear. Just imagine. And then her left hand is at her heart, the fingers pointing up in the mudra, I think it's called the mudra of the three jewels, I think. The fingers pointing up and the thumb and the ring finger holding the stem of another blue upala flower, blooming at her left ear. That's it, basically, just that. Get a feeling of this, presence of this energy in front of you. And if you have a spiritual teacher, a lama, a guru, you think this is their mind manifesting as Tara for your benefit. So it makes it very personal for you. As Prabhupada Rinpoche says, if the guru is not the Buddha, then who is? And this is a very specific part of practice when we get into Tantra, and maybe we'll discuss this, the attitude, the relationship with the teacher, the guru, which is crucial for success. So if we don't have a spiritual teacher, maybe you feel like you want one, and there's one out there somewhere. Well, you think that they're there twiddling their thumbs, waiting for you to recognize them. So you think that whoever they are, there they are manifesting as Tara to help you. You haven't recognized who they are yet, but they're waiting for you, dying to help you. So you think that that spiritual teacher of yours, whom you haven't met yet, manifesting as Tara for your benefit, solely to help you, wanting you to become your Tara, dying to help you, full of love and compassion for you. So now she very happily, Guru Tara very happily, wanting to help us, sends these radiant beams of white laser light from her brow that enter, penetrate very strongly our brow and instantly fill us with this blissful white light, completely eradicating, first of all the kind of the heaviness and of our bodies, the sickness of our bodies, you know, the difficulty to these bodies as they get older and all the rest, and the sickness of them, the pain, instantly annihilating all of this white light filling us. Imagine. And then also, the main point, instantly eradicating all the imprints in our mind of any action we've ever done since beginningless time with our bodies to harm sentient beings. So of course the Buddha is saying we've all had countless lives. We've been lions countless times, ripping out the guts of the buffaloes for breakfast daily. We've been whales countless times, and just the one whale opens its mouth for one mouthful of one breakfast, and 40 million sentient beings go in, so they're really good at killing. All the harm we've done since beginningless time to sentient beings, which have left these infinite numbers of karmic imprints in our own mind that will ripen as my suffering in the future, which I do not want. So delightedly imagining all these imprints completely gone, every bit, all the harm we've done to sentient beings with our bodies, instantly annihilated, full of this radiant white laser light. Be so delighted. Now again, Lama Tara sends from her brow very happily these powerful beams of white laser light that enter our brow, fill us completely, and this time fill us with our marvelous potential, the potential of a Buddha to effortlessly and perfectly benefit sentient beings with our body. So we think this body right now, imagine, now full of the potential to only benefit sentient beings. Can you even imagine this? Not possible to harm them. Whoever sees me, smells me, touches me, tastes me, is benefited by my physical presence. Can you imagine? And then if we can think that then the potential of a Buddha is in the future ability to manifest in countless bodies for the sake of suffering sentient beings, to benefit them, full of this marvelous potential, my own potential, this blissful white light filling me. Now Lama Tara very happily from her throat now, she sends radiant beams of red light that enter our throat, fill us instantly, first purifying, annihilating, eradicating all the imprints of all the nonsense that comes out of our mouths, that harm sentient beings. And of course, this is unique to us humans. We're very skillful at harming sentient beings with our speech. So, you know, the four ways we harm sentient beings, as it describes in the 10 non-virtues that Buddha lays out in junior school practice, the you know, the lying speech, the speech that is consciously not true, that misleads people. But, you know, I like to think also of all the speculating speech we do. We're not thinking we're lying. We're not intending to lie, but we're also clever, also well-educated. We all rabbit on and think we know the answers to things. We all say things as if we're speaking the truth, you know. We confuse people. This is called speculating. We do it much of the time. We're thinking we're true, thinking we're right. So much of this is unbelievable. This is my addition there. That's not Buddha's. Then there's all the harsh speech. Some of us might not do that, but some of us do, harming sentient beings. Then there's all the rabbiting on about nothing, called politely idle talk, but rabbiting on about nothing, this compulsion just to talk that just is exhausting to other sentient beings. And then all the one of talking behind the backs of people, which is one of our worst crimes, that creates disharmony and terrible suffering. Bad-mouthing people behind their backs. All the politicians, the family, the people at work. We practically think it's a virtue, you know. You think. Can't wait to get home to say all those awful things. So all of that, all of this harm we've done with our speech, which is the cause of so much suffering in the future as well as now, all of this, all the imprints of all of this, annihilated, eradicated by this radiant red light filling us completely, burning it all up, disappeared. Again, Lama Tara sends this red light from her throat, entering our throat, filling us this time with what else but our potential, our potential. They refer to the Buddha's speech is the Buddha's main gift to sentient beings, you know. They refer to the power of speech. Can you imagine then, full of this marvellous potential, such that any sound we utter is necessarily perfect for whoever hears it. Perfect. Can you imagine this? Every word you say is necessarily useful, beneficial, appropriate, wise, kind, even if it's just saying good morning. The power of speech, how amazing, you know, to have this. So feel full of this marvelous potential, this ability to benefit sentient beings with our speech. So incredible. Because speech is the way to help people. You know, the Buddha can be standing in front of you looking very handsome. But if he doesn't open his mouth and give you instructions, give you advice, then you're lost, you know. So speech is the most precious thing. So imagine full of this blissful red light, this potential to benefit sentient beings with our speech, which is our potential. Imagine this, full of this marvelous red light, this potential. Now Lama Tara so happily, this time sends blue light from her heart chakra in the center of her chest, blue like the sky. Powerful beams entering our heart, filling us instantly. And this time purifying the causes of suffering, the delusions, starting with the root delusion, ego grasping, known colloquially, you know, the colloquial term, which is so tasty, for ignorance, ma rigpa. this primordial ignorance that doesn't know the way things exist, that has a fantasy of the self and everything else, this root delusion, and then the attachment to get what that self wants, and then the aversion when it doesn't get what it wants, and all the other nonsense. All of these, which are the obstacles to our own liberation, obstacles to our own cessation of suffering, obstacles to our own nirvana, all of these, and all the pain and the suffering and the neuroses and the fears and the dramas that come around all of this instantly annihilated by this marvelous blue light filling us. Can you imagine? What a relief. And now again, Lama Tara sends this blue light, this time filling us with, guess what, our virtues, the natural state of our mind, all the marvelous qualities fully developed, we can imagine, bliss, kindness, joy, love, compassion, wisdom, unbelievable, blissful, in their nature, blissful. If delusions are naturally causing disturbance in the mind, then the virtues naturally cause bliss in the mind. There's this natural relationship. So imagine this, full of these marvelous qualities, my own true nature, my own potential, and bliss. Blue light filling me. And this time, now, I forget, did I do it twice? Would you do the twice? The blue. Okay, sorry, I forgot. So now, no, I didn't. We did once, the blue. So sorry, I spaced out. So now we imagine, again the blue light comes. I did. I'm so sorry. Please, I'm spaced out completely. Forgive me. So sorry. Okay, so now, Lama Tara, this time, you know, sends three lights simultaneously, because what's happening here is this has removed all, we think this has removed all the obstacles to our liberation, but we have to move even more obstacles to our omniscience, as they call it. Isn't this sort of, I heard one time that now we've removed the garlic from the jar, but now we have to remove the smell. So we think this time Tara sends the three together, white to the brow, red to the throat, blue to the heart. And this, maybe it's a bit abstract for us, imagining removing even the subtlest imprints of all delusions, all nonsense, and then at the same time manifesting our own omniscience and the two wings of the bird fully developed, our own Buddhahood, the bodhicitta and wisdom combined, the manifestation of our own omniscient mind, our own Tara nature. So these three together, imagine this. White, red, blue, filling us. Okay, so now we're going to leave the meditation there and we'll finish the second part of it before we have lunch. So relax now. Imagine you're all purified. Leave Tara there. She's hanging out in the sky. So now let's talk about dependent arising. which is the king of logics to prove emptiness. There's so many ways. There's so many ways, so many doorways, so many tools to use, so many arguments that we use, we need to use in order to conquer the misconceptions, okay? The misconception about the self and everything else. So there's different Buddhist teachings, different schools of thought that have been cultivated over the centuries in Buddhism. And there are three ways we can say, three levels of misconceptions of the I. And each of the, and then if we look at the two truths, like we mentioned yesterday briefly, one approach, and Tsongkhapa really runs with this one. He's really a great fan of using this approach to understanding emptiness, the use of the two truths, the first one being conventional reality, that things exist in dependence upon various factors. Three levels. And each of them is an argument against each of the three ways, the three levels of grasping at the self. The first is the most obvious, the most gross. The second is more subtle, and the third is the most subtle, okay? So dependent arising, things exist in dependence upon causes and conditions is the first one. Things exist in dependence upon parts is the second one. Things exist in dependence upon the mind labeling is the third one. You know? So this is the logic we need to look into in order to break down the instinctively held misconception about how I and everything else exist. So, okay, normally in life, we don't think we're not seeing things right. We think we see a chocolate cake, and that's the way it is. We think we see handsome Fred, and that's the way it is. We don't think that we're seeing things wrongly. So this is an interesting concept, and we need to see this and understand. So even if we study the mind, like we're talking about the middle scope of the teachings, high school, this is where you really learn to prepare your mind to get to the view, the most advanced level of understanding the mind, which is understanding emptiness. Because all of the delusions, attachment, anger, all the other nonsense, they all see things, cause us to see things wrongly. So here we're going to look at the root delusion, as they call it, the one that underpins all the others, the one that's there as an assumption. So in other words, attachment, which effectively, for the Four Noble Truths, is the main cause of day-to-day suffering. It's not the root delusion, but effectively it's seen as the main cause of suffering. Well, we have attachment, which is basically, we talked about already, this primordial, first of all, the energetic level, if you like, is this primordial feeling of dissatisfaction. We're born with this from practicing attachment in past lives. We're born with this terrible, aching feeling of never being enough, never having enough. And this is the junkie mind. Look at this, and we can see some people really become the junkie, desperately trying to fill that gaping hole. But we've all got it. We're all junkies. It's just a question of degree. This is the grossest level of attachment. So attachment is necessarily the response of believing in an I that exists from its own side, which is what emptiness begins to attack, the deepest one. And then aversion or anger is a response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. So they're all utterly linked, you know. In our ordinary world, who would think that anger and attachment are linked? First, we don't even have a view of attachment in our world. We think it's a good thing. We know about anger, but we don't know where it comes from. But for the Buddhist psychological view, it's so logical that aversion, anger, or indeed internalized aversion, which is depression and guilt, they are natural responses of when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And they're both underpinned by the view of there being a real, independent, solid, findable, pointable, definite, dualistic, separate, poor, pathetic, lonely, bereft, little me. As Amayeshi would call the sense of I, it's the self-pity me. It sounds so cruel, but when we look at it, we see it is true. And all Buddha's saying is, hey, baby, it's a whole load of rubbish. All these responses, all the delusions, the anger, the attachment, the pride, the jealousy, they're all based upon lies. So it's like, I believe TikTok looked at the other girl. I believe it. I believe it 1,000,000%. I believe my own view. And there's no basis in reality. He says, I didn't, Ravina. You'd think you'd be grateful and go, oh, you didn't, darling? Oh, what a relief. No, we don't say that. You did, we'll say. That all the things we do as a result of this, all the suffering, all the pain, go to the therapist, suing him, blaming him, never forgiving him for the rest of my life, all based on a lie. We can get this. We understand the idea of thinking someone did something but they didn't. We can get that. We can know it's possible. What all Buddha's saying is all these delusions, all the neuroses, all the fears are necessarily the result of believing in the root lie of all, the self-existent I. So as Lama Geshe says, Milarepa's up on the mountain laughing because he sees the truth, you know. So finally, seeing directly, seeing for the first time, as we would put it, that there isn't that I, or as Buddha would put it, seeing the absence of that I, this vivid thing called an absence, like we talked yesterday. This is like mind-boggling. As Lama Zopa says, when you first see emptiness, he says the best result, the best response, there are two responses to prove that it's a realization. We can know it intellectually, which is a good step, but to have an insight, he said the first response, which is inferior but already amazing, is unbelievable fear. And the best one is complete, unbelievable bliss. So way to go to get the realization, but we've got to start with the words, you know. We've got to get the words right. So what Buddha's saying is, all being in samsara, it's not some place, you know, where you're allowed to have sex and drugs and rock and roll, that you have to give up for boring old nirvana, which sounds like heaven, which is the dualistic view we have. It's not like that. It's so corny. Being in samsara is being caught up in these neuroses, caught up in these lies, which gives rise to continual rebirth and creates the various samsaras we have created, like lion samsara, human samsara, dog samsara, spirit samsara. They're all just these external karmic appearances, as Lama Zopa says, that we, our mind, has created. And the cause of all this? Believing in the self-existent I and everything else. So that's the biggest lie we have to cut from the mind. And that, as we said before, is the real purification. That's when you cut the root of samsara, as they say. And it's a logical thing, if we can hear it properly, if we can get beyond these Buddhist words and stop making them mystical. So why does cutting the belief in the intrinsic I stop suffering? Because attachment and anger and pride and jealousy and all the rest are the cause of suffering day to day. So as long when I finally have cut the belief in the intrinsic I, there's no longer need to have attachment to get what it wants, is there? And if I've cut attachment to getting what the I wants, then there's no anger when it doesn't get what it wants. It's obvious. They're all logically connected, you know. We have to understand that by looking at it, thinking about it, analysing it. Not from our point of view, because we've got a different view of these emotions, but from Buddha's psychological point of view, which is very precise, very particular. The words we all share, but his view of them is so very different. So, okay, let's look at dependent arising as the logic, king of logics to prove emptiness. Well, the first one, which is actually Buddha's argument with the Hindu position, because Buddha came out of Hinduism, didn't he, you know? And so he has his own arguments with their positions. So the first view, and this is called gross selflessness for most of the schools of thought in Buddhism, he argues against the view that there is something permanent, eternalistic, which is the idea of a creator or an idea of a soul. So he argues there can be no such thing. So he says that everything that does exist comes into existence in dependence upon causes and conditions. There can't be a thing. So, okay, the meaning of permanent here is quite specific. It means, it's not a word we would use. It's permanent here means not depending upon causes and conditions, being sort of a frozen in space thing that doesn't depend upon this and that for its existence. And he says no such thing can exist. It's against reality. It's an impossibility. He's not just being rude and saying there's no God. He just says a thing existing as something inherent and permanent and eternalistic can't exist. You could argue he has no problem with omniscient mind. He has no problem with the idea of consciousness pervading the universe and knowing everything, which we call God if we're Christian. But he calls it Buddha. But it's not eternalistic. It's not permanent. It is, too, the product of causes and conditions, which is why Buddha was a regular guy once who became a Buddha. That idea is shocking to those who espouse the view of God, creator, up here, eternalistic, permanent, beyond everything. It's like insulting to say that God was ordinary and became God. So it's the whole, it's that whole idea, you know, this reifying of something. Buddha's arguing with that view. So for us, this is a very practical approach in daily life because the sense of I that we have is that I'm just this product of, it's not my fault. There's nothing to do with me. I'm just stuck in stone. I got plonked on this earth by mummy, daddy, God, or someone else, and I didn't ask to get born, and it's not my fault. That's a feeling. That feeling we have is the product of believing I'm permanent. We don't think we think it's that, which is why we have to analyze it. So thinking about karma, which is causes and conditions that produced this me, is a way of breaking down this grasping at the self-existent me who didn't ask to get born, whose fault it is not. It's a very powerful way. This is the first level of dependent arising. And to think it for me, karma is the best argument. It breaks down the frantic grasping at the poor self-pity me. It's very tasty. Now the second one is the most interesting. You know, the second is so tasty, so interesting. And the second one for most Buddhist schools is subtle impermanence, subtle selflessness. But for the Prasangikas, which is the view of our lamas, it's gross selflessness. Okay. And this is the view, this is the view, this is the view. The one that's wrong is that there is an I, there is a self, there is an I that can be pointed to, that is separate from the other parts. So okay, this gets us now. We have to establish what we're discussing here. This is why it's so okay. So Buddha has this very clear way. When you study Buddhist philosophy, you learn to establish that something does exist conventionally in order to then discuss how it exists. So in order, you know, if I don't know what a cup is, I say, "Mummy, what's a cup?" Because we can't talk about it until I know what it is. And so she will give me the definition. And a definition, if you analyse it, has two parts. The first part tells you, well, she'll say, "Darling, it's that flat bottom container there, made of clay, you know, with a handle." Well, I'll see it straight away. I'll say, "Oh, I see. Yes, I see it." So the first part of a definition tells you its conventional characteristics. But I don't know what it does yet. I don't know what it really is yet. But Mummy, what is it? Oh, well, sweetheart, it holds my tea. Now I know what it is. I know its function. The second part of the definition tells you its function. But that's not enough to prove that it is a cup. We have to prove that it fulfills its function. So I'll get my pot of tea and I'll pour it and I'll go like this. And then we'll go, uh-oh, it holds my tea. So we just proved that it fulfills its function. We proved it. You can't just say you believe it's a cup. You've got to prove it. So the function is it holds tea. So I'll get my tea, I'll pour it, and it holds tea. Whoops, tick the box, it's a cup. But not enough to prove it yet. We have to then make sure there are no other valid cognitions in the mind of other people that contradict that. So once we establish that, then in this room, we will all agree it's a cup, we'll all shake hands, and we'll all buy into the belief it's a cup. That's actually how everything exists. And this, if we want to leap to the end result, this is proving subtle dependent arising, which is the third level of dependent arising, which is the hardest one of all, the most subtle. But that's another discussion. Well, it's not another discussion, but I'm just saying that. Because the Buddha says things do exist conventionally. This is dependent arising, first level. Things do exist conventionally. And look at the word conventionally, by convention. We agree it's a cup. We made it a cup. We agreed that it's a flat bottom container that holds tea. So we make it and there it does it. So there you go. So by convention. So everything that does exist, we should establish it this way. So okay, we're talking about an I. Buddha says there's no I from it. There's no I in there separate from the parts. And we'll go, okay, what's an I, Mummy? Well, you know, the word I or the word self or the word person, or the word being, they're all synonymous. They all refer to the same thing. Self, I, person, let's say. They're all the same. Okay. So there's a flat bottom container that holds tea. So let's have a definition of a person. I don't know, a mind possessor would be the best. Well, let's say a mind possessor. Well, let's say a human person. So here we've got a human person. So we'll go, what's a person, mummy? What's a human person, mummy? Well, a human person is a human being, right? Who has a mind, and they're human. That'll do as a definition. So there's one we'll go, there's one there. And then we name him, because there's Rabina's cup and there's a person. Label person who is a human and who has a mind. Okay, there's one there, and his name is Tetrarch. So we all accept that there's a person. So we do agree conventionally there's a cup. Do we accept that? We all agree that by definition there's a person, and he's labelled Tetrarch, and he's an Israeli, and we prove that he is that, and there's no valid cognition that can find that he isn't the Israeli person called Tetrarch. So we accept he's Tetrarch, okay? So we all buy into that, and now we all shake hands and we agree this object here is called a person. You understand? You accept that? You accept that? Now we can begin to discuss how the cup exists, because we've all agreed what a cup is. We now look into how it does exist. Because Buddha says we have layers upon layers of delusions in the mind that project onto that cup that does exist qualities that don't exist. Are you with me? Same with everything that exists. So here we're discussing the way the I exists, our person, our being, our person, our I. Each of us is our own I, okay? So do you agree that if he's a person, he fits the definition, that each of us is a person, right? We are a person. You accept? You're not a cup, you're not a knife, you're not a toilet. All right? You're called a person. You agree? Conventionally, you're a person. Okay, now let's look at how that person exists, right? Because Buddha says we've got it wrong. Okay? So, this second level of dependent arising is that Buddha's saying, I'm sorry, guys, there is a person there. Conventionally, the label person is the correct label for this object called human, this one. But we think, we make a mistake, and we over-exaggerate that, we embellish it, and we think there has to be a self-existent person. We think in here, among these parts, and let's break it down to two, we've got the body and we have the mind, using Buddha's view. Buddha actually has this description of the five aggregates. You know, he sat down and pointed and made this, you know, come up with this, the components of a person of the five aggregates. And he's got a very particular reason for choosing those five. And we'll go into that, maybe we won't. But never mind, let's just make it two. It keeps it simple. Two parts, okay? You've got your body, which is all the physical bits, yeah? Your pee-pee, your caca, your bones, your brain. Yes, you agree? Bits, parts, lots and lots and lots of parts. There'd be thousands if you started writing them all down. Would you agree with that? And they're the parts of this object called person. Would you agree? Like the clay and the paint are the parts of this object called cup. You accept this? Okay, good. Then we have another part called mind, and we're taking Buddha's view here, which is not physical. Can we accept that? And that mind has parts, doesn't it? What are the parts of your mind? What would be some of the names of the parts of your mind? Good, thoughts. And give some of the names of the thoughts. Anger, love, compassion, joy. Yeah, you agree? Lots and lots of those. Yes, you accept this, don't you? Accept this. So we've made up of lots and lots of parts. Would you agree with that? Yeah? And there's anger, there's love, there's kindness, there's joy, there's this, there's that. Millions of them. And there's lots and lots of the parts of the body. And you can label them all. Would you agree with that? Okay. Now, what Buddha's saying, we think, is that there's another part called self, called I, that isn't the blood, that isn't the bones, that isn't the anger, that isn't the jealousy, that isn't the this and isn't the that. In other words, as one of my friends Penday said, we think there is another part called I walking hand in hand with the rest of the parts. Can you hear those words? Now already we're confused. Why? Because we think there is that. Even as we're talking, the language we're using is implying that there is an I that does the thinking. There is an I that is speaking. There is an I that watches the breath. There is an I that gets angry. There is an I that gets depressed. There is an I that's beautiful. You accept my words, don't you? We say all these words, don't we? And we buy into them. So this is the point. Conventionally, it is not wrong to say those words. It is a correct statement. But our problem is the delusion in us, the ego grasping, the root delusion, the marigpa, has got this misconception and has believing in this misconception since beginningless time that makes more, that exaggerates the I, embellishes the I, makes more of the I than there really is. And we believe, and putting it in this second level of dependent arising, there is an I in there that is running the show, that's running the parts. It's like the boss or the puppeteer or the landlord. that runs, and that part's called I. So we believe there is a part called I that does exist in there somewhere, but somehow running the show. You accept that you think that?
Yeah.
Okay. And believing in that is why you get upset when someone insults you, or why you get blissful if someone gives you something, why you feel hungry, and all the delusions, all the attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, are all the responses to the belief in that I. And all Buddha's saying is, hey, baby, there isn't. There's not that one. Don't chuck the baby out with the bathwater. You do exist conventionally. And this is the tricky part. This is kind of squeezes our brain. So basically, speaking in real simple terms, Buddha is saying conventionally there is an I, no probs. But at the same time, ultimately, there is nothing. And this is the subtlest level now, because this leads us to the subtlest level, that there is not a single thing in and of itself from the side of the I. There is nothing in the parts that you will find that is labeled I. Because I, finally, is a name, a sound, a word we use to refer to the parts. These are the words, okay? They're not complicated, but because they're not words that we know as true, we can't hear them. But this is just a simple way of saying. And these are the words, we have to put meat onto these bones of these words and to see the truth of these words through practice, you know. And so we have to do lots and lots of arguing with the mistaken beliefs in the mind, deep in our bones, that are the basis of all suffering. All suffering, period. So it's just a little exercise. There's different exercises, tricky little exercises that we can do. So let's say I say, don't go past there, just stay here. I say the statement, my table has a cup, a vase, and a lid. Okay, now look with your eyes, because we know, don't we, that a sound coming out of this mouth here, and when the sound sounds like my table, because we know the definition of my, we've defined what a my is. My is referring to the I who speaks, and it's referring to an object owned by that I, isn't it? So we've got each of these words, we've defined them all, but we're all used to them, so we say it quickly. We know what my says. If I say my table, you won't look over there, will you? You'll look here next to the I who says it. Do you get my point? So we know the definition of my. We know the definition of table, don't we? Flat top with legs that holds things. There it is. We know the definition of a cup or mug, you know. We know the definition of a vase. We know the definition of a lid. We've analysed all these. We've been to school. We've learned all these things. They become very automatic to us, don't they? So we know logically that's a true statement. My table has a cup, a vase, and a lid. Do you accept? It's a correct statement. Wouldn't you agree? Okay. So to really prove it's true, to prove the truth of that conventionally, what we'll need to do is make sure, and we need to find a cup that isn't a table, a vase, and a lid. We're going to have to find a table that isn't a cup, a vase, and a lid. Can you get the point? You've got to point out four separate phenomena. Do you accept that? My table is the name of this table, a cup, a vase, and a lid. So then you've really proven that there are four separate conventional phenomena, each with their own name, their own function, conventionally. You accept? It's a reasonable thing to say, isn't it? Perfectly reasonable. You accept? Okay. Well, I will say that I have a nose, a hand, and a foot. Can you see that this is a true statement? You know that I is a name that I will use to refer to me. It's a conventional label we've used to refer to this human being called Rabina. You accept that? A conventional object that does exist. A conventional object that does exist called I. Yeah? I have a nose, a hand, and a foot. Do you accept that as a truth? Conventionally. There's a nose, yeah? Hand and foot. You accept this conventionally. Conventionally, yeah? Ordinary. So let's prove that conventionally. That means you have to find a hand that is not a nose, an eye, or a foot. We have to find a nose that is not a hand, an eye, and a foot, etc. You with me? So let's do that, shall we? Let's take the hand. Put it on there. There it is, a hand, look. Then there's a nose. Here it is. There's a foot. Cut it off, put it there. Now we have to cut off the eye. We have to find the piece that isn't a nose, that isn't a hand, that isn't a foot, that isn't the mind, that isn't anger, that isn't love, that isn't jealousy, that isn't pee-pee, that isn't caca. You with me? That isn't all the other parts, every tiny fraction of every part, that isn't any of those, and put that there. So now that's the tricky part, isn't it? So where is the I that isn't the parts? Any ideas? Because we believe there's an I, don't we? If we didn't, we wouldn't get upset if people insulted us. Say that again. What are you saying? Is this Kitty? Take the mic. So, Kitty, the job here is we're trying to locate. It's a very specific job we're doing in this discussion. We're trying to find an eye here that isn't the other parts, like we did with these four things here. So, point out which piece would be the eye that isn't those other parts. That's the discussion here. What's wrong? What's happening? Okay, good. So now try and point out to me where you think, what you think that eye is that isn't the parts, Kitty. That's the discussion here. That's the point. So please point that out.
I think that eye is a kind of verbal we use to describe it. There isn't an eye there.
Good. Okay, that's the right answer. But did you get bliss or terrible fear when you said that?
No.
Okay, good. Well, you said the right words. That's perfect. You said the right words. That's
yeah,
fine.
I understood it intellectually.
You've got the right words. It's a good start. Okay? Anyone else like to point out where the eye is? The one that we believe in so totally, that we think is there, and even as we're thinking it and saying it, we're believing it's there. That gets insulted, that is hurt, that has anger, that is loving, that is depressed, that gets lust, that feels bad, that is guilty, that is beautiful, is ugly, is fearful. This one. Tell us. What do you think? Which bit is it? Because put this way, Buddha says if it does exist, it wouldn't take too long to look. If there does exist on this table, those three things, it wouldn't take long to locate them if they do exist. So if there is an eye that does exist there that isn't the parts, you just have to search. It shouldn't take too long to find it. So what do you think it is? What's your speculation?
I would like to point out, I find a contradiction.
Which bit? Where's the
in
contradiction?
The process that the more I give away I...
No, sorry, what? The more you what?
The way I... The more I give away the idea of a self...
What do you mean, give it away?
Well,
Listen, I don't want that yet. Let's stick to the topic. We'll discuss that in a minute. I want you to try and point out to me where that eye is. We have to first establish
where is
this.
It?
That's what I'm asking. Where is this eye that isn't your parts? That's the discussion. Then we can go on to your next point.
I don't think it's visible.
What, darling?
I don't think it's visible.
Visible. Okay, what is it then if it's not visible? What is it? Give it a name. If it exists, it must have a name.
It's experiential.
So what is it then? What's the name of this
it's
part of
you? It's something you experience.
But what is the name of it? Give it a name. If it does exist, it's got to be an individual, distinct thing that has a name
it's
and a function.
It's been given many names.
Some people
call it the soul.
Sweet. Okay, good, good, good. Now we're getting somewhere. Good, good, good. Okay, what's your name again?
Tony.
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 Okay, good. You're suggesting there is a thing called a soul. Are you suggesting that, Tony?
It is that word has been used to describe.
Tony, I'm asking you what you think. Do you think there is a part called the soul?
Yes.
Be fine. It's okay to think it.
Yes.
So good. Another word for that is I or self. Buddha says the Hindu word Atma is translated as self, and the equivalent in Christians is soul. So good. You're suggesting there is a part called a self or a soul.
Yes.
You are suggesting that. Okay. So can you describe it, please? What is it? How is it existing? Once you've rid yourself of all the other parts, so you're saying there is a piece there that's called a soul. Yeah?
Spirit. Sense of
You're calling
spirit.
It spirit. Okay, another term for it, spirit. So yeah. It isn't, it's not a function of your consciousness?
It's
not a
suffering. I think it's, I don't think it's just a function of the mind.
What is it then?
I think it's a mixture of
okay,
mind.
Okay, it's a mixture of what?
Mind and heart.
Okay, good,
and
good,
body.
Good, good. Okay, so there is a part called I, or self, or Atma, that is a mixture of heart, mixture of kindness and love, those things. So you're saying that the I is, the soul is love. Yeah? You're saying that? So what's love? Tony, define love for me. You've got to define it.
See,
Tony, listen, can you sort of see where I'm going here? This is the analysis that we have to
do. I think it's to do with recognizing one's connection with everybody else.
Good, very good, nice. Buddha would agree. So there is a part of Tony called love. Is it a part of his body or his mind? Which is it?
I'm not sure that I agree
okay,
with the total separation of body and mind.
Oh, okay, so it's body and mind.
I think body has
okay,
body,
so
body
cup,
has a wisdom
too. The cup
too.
Is also a vase, is it?
Yes.
Tony, you've got a long way to go, according to the Buddha. It's okay, you're just expressing what we all think, and this is the type of analysis that Buddha says we need to do, because what he's saying is you won't find that inherent I or soul or Atma or heart or spirit or this or that, and that it can't be a combination of this and that, that we've got to pinpoint it and label it and name it, because what he's saying is our believing in an I that doesn't exist is why we have suffering and anger and fears and jealousy and drama and wars and violence and all the rest. So it's quite a specific and subtle point that he's making. And he says that they, in the monasteries, they study this for 30 years and then they go meditate on it for another 30 in order to discover it. This is essentially, as the Dalai Lama points out, this is the Hindu discussion for 3,000 years ago that began this. And then Buddha came out of that and carried this discussion further. And then we're discussing in this room his findings about I. And all he's saying is when we've rid the mind of the belief in this fantasy I, then that's what liberation from all suffering is.
So we don't call it
anything? Huh?
So we don't call it anything?
No, you just chuck the baby out with the bathwater. You just said there's no I. And Buddha's not saying there's no I. He's saying there's no inherent I. And that's the tricky part. And that's the part that's tricky, because we assume, we don't know we think this, but the I that we think is there, he says we think it's inherent. We think it doesn't depend upon causes and conditions, it doesn't depend upon the parts, and it doesn't finally depend upon the mind naming it. He says this is the I we think that's there, and he says that one can't be there because it can't exist like that. So the way Lama Zofa puts it, when you finally realized the emptiness, the absence of that fantasy I, what's your name? What's the name of your eye? Glenn.
Yeah.
Thank you, Glenn. So as Lama Zopa says, once you have seen directly the insight into the emptiness of inherent Glenn, it's as if there's no Glenn. But there is.
Is it possible?
Just a minute. Because what does exist, there is a Glenn. But what does exist is so subtle, it's as if there's no Glenn. It's as if it's an illusion. So it's a bit like sort of smoke and mirrors. And it's not meant to be just tricky. So this is what we have to put together, all these ideas. And it is extreme, and this is my point, even with a few questions to Tony, we have to be incredibly precise. It's like being, you know, like autistic with numbers. It's like you've got to be so precise, so exact. That's why I'm getting all the point of defining what is this, what is that. It's got to, if it does exist, it's got to be this, it's got to be that. Define it. All these things, we've got to establish all this, and then we have to search for that one to discover, finally, the absence of that one. And then it's as if there's no I, but it's like then you discover the real Glenn, if you like, putting it this way. You know. It's the words for it.
Is it called presence?
Is what called presence?
The I.
So there is, you think there is an I. You're saying there is an I. There is, you're saying there is, give her the mic, please. So you're agreeing with Tony?
The who?
There you go. You're agreeing with Tony that there is an eye in there that you can find that isn't the nose, isn't the heart, isn't the love, isn't the hate, isn't the this and isn't... So you're agreeing with the Hindus and you're agreeing with the Christians and you're agreeing with Tony that there is an eye, a self-existent eye. You're agreeing with that. First, establish this, please.
Yes, I do. I do, yes.
Okay, so what is it called? What's the name of this eye that you think is there? The Christians call it a soul. The Hindus call it an Atma. He calls it a spirit, you know. What do you call it?
The only way I understand it is the present, now.
Huh? Which part of you is that? Where's that bit in you? We're talking about you, dear. I forget your name.
Valerie.
We're talking about Valerie. And Valerie, you are saying there is a part of Valerie that is the self. And now you just said it's now. Well, now is the name of a piece of time. A piece of time is not a part of Valerie. I'm sorry. That's another phenomenon called time. Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting Valerie possesses a piece of her called time.
Yes.
In Valerie's body and mind. Mm. Yes. There's a piece called time.
Yes.
Oh, very interesting. Where do we find that, please? Is it in your body or your mind?
Is it in
your body or your mind?
In my mind.
So in your mind, there's a piece of your mind called now.
Yes.
A piece of your mind. Yes. So what are the components of your mind? What are the parts of your mind called? What are the parts of your mind, Valerie? What are they called?
Death.
No, darling, what are the parts of your mind? Mm. What is the mind, please? You see, thoughts. What you're working thoughts. On is a whole bunch of different... Okay, there's a thought. So there's a piece of... One of your thoughts... There's a thought that we can label anger, which is an aversion when your attachment doesn't get what it wants. And there's another piece of your thought called attachment, which is the belief that the chocolate cake will make you happy. There's another piece of your mind called love, which is the wish that others be happy. There's another part of your mind called compassion, which is the thought, which is the wish that others not suffer. Do you accept all those as definitions?
Yes.
So you're saying there's another part of your mind called death?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. What's the function of death, this part of your mind called death? Well, how would you define that thought, death?
I think it's the only way I understand it is because
I understand what? Death? But what's death? What's death, please? What's the term death refer to? If you see death, what are you seeing? Who? What dies?
Not being alive.
Okay, good. So what is not being alive? A person, isn't it? Or a dog.
Yes.
That's a person. So death is what occurs to a person when the mind leaves the body. Mm. Well, you just said death is a thought, is a part of your mind.
Mm.
So which one is it? Make up your mind. Is it just part of your mind, or is it what happens to an animal when the mind leaves? Which is death, darling?
It's when the soul leaves the mind.
Which soul? What's this soul you're talking about? Valerie, are you getting a sense of where I'm going with all this?
I am.
What's the point of all this discussion? Not just to be clever. What's the point of this discussion? What are we trying to establish here, Valerie? What am I trying to establish? Not about you.
Mm.
What am I trying to establish, Valerie?
You're trying to establish that...
Whether or not there is a what?
There is a mind.
No, dear, we're not discussing the mind. We've established there's a mind.
An I.
There's a self-existent I.
Yeah.
We're trying to establish that.
Yes.
Right. I think you're trying to establish other things. So that's why we're discussing it cross purposes.
Yes.
So then would someone else like to establish what they think their eye is? Over here, please. What do you want to do then? Okay. Whatever it is, ask it. It's okay. What do you want to ask?
I don't know what I think about I. I just wanted to know what... once you realise the emptiness of I...
Yep. How would you be?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, baby.
Yeah.
I will tell you.
What, you know,
I
what,
tell
what's
you,
it like? Where's
I
the,
will
where's,
tell you.
Where's the karma?
You will be completely blissful. You will be loving, kind, wise, confident, joyful, fearless. Doesn't that sound nice?
Mm. So is it... of the nature of a stream of consciousness.
What is? What's the nature of a stream of consciousness?
I don't know.
Well, then don't ask if you don't know what you're asking.
What's left? You realise the emptiness of the eye. What's the nature of what carries on?
That's a different discussion, dear. We're just in discussion now.
I thought I might be going off on a tangent. Sorry.
No, we've got to... Listen to me. Our trouble is we all use all these words in a big muddled way of soup, you know? Mm. That's what I keep trying to do. It sounds sort of rather boring, intellectual and abstract, defining what we're talking about first.
Mm.
So what's your name? I forget.
Maggie.
All the Buddha's saying is when Maggie, which is the name we use for this person here, who is made up of body and mind, which is the conventional term for this person here as opposed to that person there, when Maggie's mind does the job of analysing all this in meditation and finally gets to see the absence of the fantasy Maggie that she's been clinging to since beginningless time, the absence of that fantasy, Maggie. The absence of that fantasy, Maggie. Are you hearing that?
Yeah.
like the absence of blue, the absence of whatever, you know, when you see the truth. When you finally have even the first moment of seeing the absence of it, it's like this mind-blowing paradigm shift that occurs in your life and your being. And from there on, you can't go back into more suffering. You can only continue to eventually get all the realizations and become this liberated being who is blissful and clear and wise, whose mind sees the past and the future and the minds of all others and has infinite compassion and has the power also, when you're a Buddha, to finally manifest in millions of trillions of bodies throughout trillions of universes to benefit trillions of sentient beings. So it's a big ask we're discussing here. So what's left is your mind still continuing. There's no difference. It will be beginningless and endless continuity of mental moments. But what's happening is you're purifying this mind of yours. You're ridding the pollution from it, the misconceptions. And then as you keep progressing from this moment of realization of emptiness on further up, bodhicitta, all the other things, you keep getting more and more power, more and more realizations, more and more compassion, more and more wisdom, until eventually you become Buddha. Can you just hear the words? That's all. Just hear the words first. Get the words right first. Okay? Go, darling. Over here, please.
I'm not sure if this is a smart question, but...
Darling, don't worry about smart. Just say whatever.
So you said that minds...
What's with that?
You said that a mind or the mind carry on...
A mind, a thing,
carry on like
a conventional exile. Phenomenon that's labelled mind, which is a river of mental moments, basically. And we've got, you know... Yes, that's right. Mind.
Yeah, so my question is, so how...
Can you go a bit closer to the mic, sweetheart?
How do you define
mind? So what is mind? The definition of mind for the Buddha, it's got two parts, like all definitions. The first part tells you its conventional... Keep the mic there. It tells you its conventional characteristics. So as we've been discussing, for the Buddha, the word mind is used to refer first to something that is not physical. I'm not discussing the brain. So there's a part of you that's known as your mind, and it refers to this first part, which the term they use is simply clarity or luminosity, which simply refers to something that isn't physical. So the conventional characteristics of your mind is that it's clear, not physical. But the second part tells you its job, its function. Yeah? You with me? And that is... to cognize, to be aware, to know. That's its job. So what is it to cognize? That which exists. So for the Buddha, the part of you, what's your name?
Magdalena.
Magda. Okay, Magda. So the part, you know, you're made up of two bits, the body and the mind. The body is just these four elements that came into, you know, coming from your mummy and daddy's egg and sperm, and as we know, they're getting more wrinkled and old, and eventually it'll stop functioning, all the bits of the body. And then what's left is your consciousness or your mind. These words are used synonymously. So for the Buddha, this consciousness or this mind of yours is not physical. And it's a beginningless continuity of mental moments, and it's an endless continuity of mental moments. And right now, if you are deluded like the rest of us, then you're miserable, you suffer, you have ego, you get depressed, angry, hurt others, and you keep being reborn because of these neuroses in the mind. And these neuroses in the mind, Buddha says, don't belong there. We can rid the mind of them. And what we're describing in this process is the process yesterday and today of how to get rid of the neuroses in your mind which are causing all your suffering. And when they're all gone from the mind, your mind is liberated from suffering, and then eventually you become an enlightened mind. And then your consciousness pervades the universe, is wherever there is existence, is omniscient, sees everything as it is, sees the minds of all beings, has infinite compassion with every single one of them, and has infinite power to benefit every one of them. This is what Buddha says about the mind and its potential.
So if someone...
Why isn't this mic working, Erica?
Does it work? Yeah. So okay. If someone put just a different label on mind of this, what you just described,
yes.
Let's say soul, would
okay.
you agree?
Yeah.
Would you agree that there is something which, as you said, carry on?
Of course.
From
it's called,
one.
That's the point. That's an interesting point, okay? So let's look at two things here. It's very interesting. When, this is Glenn's point. When we hear, he said, oh, well, so there's nothing, he said. Because it does seem like when we're talking that what we're doing is we're getting rid of everything and then we end up with nothing. But that's not the conclusion. It's more subtle than that. So if we think of God, Or we think of soul, which are from the religions we tend to know, aren't they? If you've been brought up a Christian or a Muslim, the general idea we have is there is something out there, and we call it God. And if we want to articulate that for the Christians and the Muslim, for the Christians and the Muslims, it's energy that isn't physical, that's all-knowing, all-seeing, pervades the universe, and is infinitely compassionate. Would you agree with that? Would you agree? Generally speaking, would you agree with that definition of God?
I don't really believe in God.
So, I don't so either, but I'm asking you for the people. I don't care what you believe.
So I didn't
I'm talking
really
about what the world says. Magda, can you get my point?
I can see your point. That's fine.
So listen, darling, listen to my point. Yeah. Okay. And then the other job that they give to that energy is to create things, isn't it? Wouldn't you agree? And they say he's the source of all the universe. Would you accept that that's what we call God? Well, leave the second part out. But if you take the first part, Buddha agrees there is such a thing as omniscient mind that pervades the universe, that knows everything and has infinite compassion. He calls it enlightened mind. And what he says is every single being's mind can become that. So can you hear those words, Magda? So
yes,
in a sense,
yes,
you can say he agrees with omniscience, all-knowing, all-seeing, all-loving, all-pervading, but he doesn't give it the job of making things. He says that's an unnecessary embellishment. That's an over-exaggeration of the job of that thing, because he says every being has a mind, and every being's mind can become Buddha mind, can become enlightened mind. So that's the first point. Now, the second point is, as you just very wisely said, Magda, if we give it a different name, what you just said, can we call it a soul? Sure. Also the same. Christians would say there is a thing that does go after death. But the difference is, and so would a Buddha, but the difference is in the label. One says it's consciousness, one says it's soul, but the main difference, like with God or Buddha, is the way it exists, where it comes from, how it exists, and its potential. And that's where the major discussion is. So a soul is said to be something that God gives you. It's said to be inherent. It's said to have to be somehow a secret thing that just sit in stone. It's permanent. It has no causes. God gives it to you. And, you know, and then it goes to hell or heaven because God sends you there. So that's a very different interpretation. The Buddha says that he calls it consciousness or mind. But what the West says, the materialist view says mind is this brain up here. But he doesn't say that. The Christians say it's this secret thing that God gives you. Not being sarcastic, but God gives you it. And then it's up to God whether you go to hell or heaven. But the Buddha says, no, baby, you've got a consciousness that's beginningless, so you don't need creating. And that this view of karma, which is everything that goes on in that mind, that process is what produces you, turns you into a happy person, ugly person, nice person, suffering person, or whatever. So we're the boss. We're the creator of ourselves, and we can become an enlightened mind. So we do have a mind. We do have a consciousness. It does continue, but it's not inherent. It's not given to us. It's not set in stone. It's got infinite potential. And so the difference then in Buddhism is this view of emptiness, the view of dependent arising, the view of how things exist, not so much whether it does exist. That's the major difference. And that's the finer point. So he's not saying there's nothing. That's plain nihilism. And let's face it, that's the materialist view. We chuck it all out. Oh, there's no creator, there's no soul, we're just the body. That's the nihilistic view. Well, they're the two extreme views, the Buddha says. So when he talks about the two truths, and we're going to hear like this, there is no cup from its own side. There is nothing, these are the words the Buddha would say, there's nothing from the side of the cup that makes it a cup. It is completely empty of existing as an inherent cup. Now, as soon as we hear those words, we go, uh-oh, there's no cup, and we chuck the baby out with the bathwater. That's the nihilistic philosophy, which is nonsense, which is an over-exaggeration and a mistake. And then as soon as we hear there is dependent arising, which is the conventional truth that there is a cup that does function that holds my tea, we get all excited and we reify it and we see it as eternal and we go, oh, thank God, there's a cup after all. Grasp. That's the reification process. Now, that philosophically is the Christian and the Muslim teaching, and this one philosophically is the materialist view. And Buddha says they're the two extreme views that exist in minds. And he says he's got the view that there is a cup that does exist, that does hold my tea, but there is no cup from its own side. that we can point to. And this is the part that seems so, that squeezes our brain and we go crazy. So then, in fact, they're not only just not contradictory, they actually mean the same thing. So one practice, so in other words, when you say there is a cup that does exist in dependence upon this and that, what we're actually saying is that proves there is no cup from its own side. And this is the tricky part. It's not just sounds like clever words, but this is said to be an expression of reality, and it's the insight into this in meditation that liberates us from suffering, Buddha says. Are we communicating?
All right. Thank you, yes.
Okay. So, of course, it's up to us which views we decide, whether Valerie and her views, and up to her to find out where she belongs and what views she finds appealing, whether her own views or she likes Jesus' views or whoever's views she wants, or if she wants to pursue Buddha's views or her own views. It's up to each person. It's up to each one of us to call the shots, because we're the boss, not Buddha. We're the boss, not Buddha. We have to find out. And as we can see in this room, we're speaking words. Valerie speaks her words. Tony's speaking his words. Glenn says his. You say yours. Each of us, they're just words, and what words are an expression of the thoughts in our mind. And this is where Buddha says all the dramas are, all the suffering is, and all the happiness. And it's up to us to investigate this mind, our thoughts. And this is the key point about thoughts that Buddha's making. Everything in our mind is a thought, comes down to a thought. Even the subtlest ones, they're just habits of thoughts, that's all. And we finally get down to them. There's going to be two things about thoughts. One is that there are some thoughts that are thoughts, but are expressions of that which exists. And that's a valid thought. And then there are some thoughts that are expressions of things that don't exist, and they're invalid thoughts. And Buddha says our minds are riddled right now with invalid thoughts. Thoughts that are not in sync with reality. So one of those thoughts is called attachment. You know, I'm attached. I see a chocolate cake. A chocolate cake does exist. It is a chocolate cake. You can even say it won the prize in the Women's Institute, the blue ribbon. It's even a good chocolate cake. This is a valid statement, a conventional statement of truth. But what we don't see is, in our mind, at the same time as seeing a good chocolate cake, we're imposing upon it, or as Lama Zopa puts it, our delusions in the mind, our misconceptions, our invalid thoughts, our wrong thoughts, which are deeply habitual, are instantaneously decorating on top of what is there characteristics that aren't there. This is what Buddha says we're doing all the time, and we can't see the difference. And the tragedy is, for so long have we been decorating on top of chocolate cake the characteristic, for example, of delicious chocolate cake, that when such that when I eat it, I'll get happy. Divine Fred, such that when I have him, I will be happy. This is a simple lie. And we need to be analytical about it and to investigate, to discover that attachment, that simple lie in the mind that embellishes the deliciousness of something, that then causes the lie that says that when I eat it, I'll get happy, that then causes us to crave it again, believing I'll get happy again, is a stinking, rotten load of lies. It isn't like that. It appears to be like that. We believe it's like that, but he says it's not like that. And that's the type of analysis we have to do. And you can't avoid that analysis, he says. In the long term, this is what being a Buddhist means. That's why we have to have single point of concentration. We have to study Buddha's model of the mind, if we choose, and we have to apply it in our meditation to slowly unpack these lies. And there's trillions of them, and they're layered magnificently into this perfect conceptual construction and have been doing it for eons. And so deeply entrenched and instinctive are these lies that they not only don't see the truth, they cause even the cake to appear like that. We think the cake is delicious, and we think poor me has to eat the cake. Look, that cake, it's all the cake's fault, isn't it? What can I do? I've just got to stuff myself with it. Look at the cake, so divine. Complete nonsense, Buddha says. It's the other way around. My mind is projecting onto it all these things, and then that causes the cake to look like that. This is the worst part. And then we believe it's true. So we're all living in this insane asylum, Buddha says. Ordinary life. He says we're all insane. We're all mad as hatters. Mad as snakes, as we say in Australia. So it's quite tricky because we can't see it. And we're talking ordinary here. Ordinary daily delusions. Ordinary daily misconceptions that are completely instinctive. And the deepest lie of all, the hardest one to see, that, you know, not only do we see a delicious cake, not only do we see a cake that'll make me happy, that causes all the, you know, the craving and the nonsense, we see an intrinsically delicious cake, delicious from its own side, and that's the part that squeezes our brain, you know. So slowly, slowly. It's up to us. Go into it. And that's why his holiness, every time he gets a second chance when he's teaching, he's got to study the teachings. You see, this is when we think of it as a belief system. And it's okay, you can. You can believe in Buddha, I'm happy. You can believe in goodness, aren't you fortunate you believe in goodness instead of badness? You can even believe in karma, I'm very happy for you. But it's like saying you believe in music, or you believe in cooking, or you believe in mathematics. How do you do it? Oh, I don't know. You can't get far with that, I'm sorry. It doesn't last long. And we think of religion as belief, and that's fine if you're a Christian. That's correct. If God is the boss, and he made the universe, and he's omnipotent and all-knowing, it's none of your damn business what God has. You better put up with his plans. That's real faith. That's amazing. If every Christian and Muslim who said they were Christian and Muslim had faith in God, that'd all be blissful. But look at us, you know. We don't want to believe in God, and we moan and complain when God does his trip. Excuse me. It's an intense view, amazing view. It's just not how Buddha talks, that's all. Different, you know. Because that's up to us. We can decide what we want to do. And we can have our own view. Valerie can have her own view. It's up to her. She's the boss. She can believe in death being a thing and time, whatever she said. That's her call. We're the boss, baby. That's why I like Buddha. He says, I'm the boss. I like that. But you've got to be brave, because that means you've got to be accountable. You can't blame somebody. You can't say, oh, it's not my fault, you know, which ego loves to do that. Are we communicating? Now we've got to finish Tara before lunch. What's your question?
I just wanted to clear something up.
Okay, darling. I'm very happy. What is it?
We have this I that we assume is referred to.
The self-existent I, the Buddha says, isn't there?
Yeah, the self-existent I.
Okay.
That we as humans, there is us, there is I. And that's what gives us all the delusions, which are the feelings.
The belief in the self-existent I is the source of having attachment, anger, pride and jealousy, which cause all the suffering in day-to-day life. Yes.
Yeah, and then you've got the consciousness that goes... Consciousness?
Well, darling, it's just you've got a mind. It's all you. Your is just mind. Made
yeah,
of a mind and body.
That's attached to our body. Our
it's just
mind.
Your mind and your body, that's all. Your
brain,
mind is
your
thoughts.
Your brain and your mind. Okay,
so no, your brain is not your mind, baby. That's your body.
Yeah.
So what you're asking?
I'm just trying to clear it up in my own
which
head.
Bit, what are you trying to clear up, Petal? I know, darling, you are thinking about it. It's fine. What are you trying to clear up? You mean what does exist as opposed to what doesn't? You exist.
Yeah.
Sweetie, you exist.
Yes,
hey.
Yes.
What's your name?
Vanessa.
You kept telling me. Vanessa does exist, all right?
Yeah.
She does exist.
Mm-hmm.
It's the name. But the right way to put it, simple, is Vanessa is the name we give to these
to
parts.
To this body. This
now,
body.
Listen to this. We go, oh, thank God, there's parts. No, baby. Vanessa's ear is a name we give to those parts, isn't it? You with me?
Yes.
What's
yes,
the name
yes,
of that
I
ear?
Am.
That's called Vanessa's ear there, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's the that's name we give to this
is,
flappy
yeah.
thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Would you agree? So,
yeah.
Oh, thank God. But there's no Vanessa's ear. Vanessa's ear is merely the name we give to those parts. We go, oh, well, there's a flap. Oh, that's good. I've got a flap here. No. Ear flap is a name you give to those parts. You with me?
Yes, I've got that.
Okay, every time you point to something,
There
does exist Vanessa.
Mm-hmm.
Vanessa does exist. Vanessa is a name we give to the parts sitting on that cushion.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go, oh, what a relief. There must be a body and a mind. Yes, we think that instinctively.
Yeah.
No, because Vanessa's body is a name we give to those parts.
Yes.
Blood, bones, pee pee, caca. Okay? So then we go, oh, thank God, there is some pee-pee and caca. No, dear, because pee-pee is a name you give to that part.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's the liquid. No. The yellow liquid that comes out is the name we give to those parts. So whatever you do, you have a name, and a name is referring to parts.
Mm-hmm.
But the name, like Lama Zopa says, can never be the parts. The name can't be the basis. The name can't be the basis. It's just a name. And everything you point to, it's like that. Mm-hmm. So there is a Vanessa, there is PP, there is a nose, there is an eye, but they're names given to their parts.
Yeah. So when you die, when this body that...
When the body and the mind leave, separate, then...
And I've got whatever that is that leaves, or...
No, it's called mind for the Buddha, consciousness.
Mind, mind, yeah.
It's called consciousness or mind. These words are synonymous. What's the question?
Where, how does that stay together?
God Almighty. This is what... Okay. Tell me, it's a great question. It's a perfect question. Yeah, that's the law. See, if we're Christians, God does it. If we're materialists, it's just the material, and we're not quite sure what goes on there. Yeah. Buddha's view is it's what you put into that mind, all the programming, all the imprints. So if you program your... Okay, you're saying, here we go. You got Vanessa's been practicing piano for 20 years, let's say.
Yeah.
Okay? And what happens is she goes to the piano and it just whizzes up and down. The fingers go whizzing up and down, don't they? Spontaneously. So what causes you to play the piano? What makes it all, what holds it all together? What causes the fingers to whiz up and down the piano? What's the main cause? What's the main cause?
It's your body, or you've practiced.
Excuse
you've done
me,
it
your fingers running
you've
up and down
it.
The piano is not the main cause. What causes your fingers to know what notes to go on? What?
Your mind.
Your mind, good, practice. So you programmed your mind, didn't you? You sort of programmed your mind in a certain direction such that your fingers will just do it every time. You accept that?
Yeah.
So then every time you get angry, you're programming your mind to get getting angry. Every time you lie, you're programming your mind to keep lying. So you die fully programmed, baby. The certain karmic imprints is ripen at the time of death. And then if you die in this life, let's say with anger and let's say... grasping and anger and from past killing and stuff, you've programmed your mind beautifully with those habits. The killing karma will ripen, you'll leave this birth and you will run like a magnet, driven by your wish to run to that lion mummy's womb that looks so gorgeous, and you'll just keep on killing, babe. You created the cause to be that lion. What drives you? What pushes it? Your own past actions, your own past mental practice. We're driven by the force of our own past actions. Okay. Just like you're driven by the force of your past practice when you play piano, it's like that. Minds don't need a boss up there pulling the strings called God. Minds are driven by whatever's in them. Do you hear that?
Yeah, I do.
That's the answer to your question.
Yeah, I guess where it's coming from with me, it was somebody the other day was talking about how you can have twin souls, which is a God thing.
I don't want to talk about twin souls. What's a twin soul? What do you mean?
What's a twin soul,
please?
Well, it's
give me a definition.
I don't know. But it's
well, then don't say you don't know. Hey, Vanessa. Vanessa.
Yeah.
This is our problem with words. We're so airy fairy. You say twin soul, then I say, what is it? I don't know. Well, then don't talk about it.
Okay.
If you don't know.
Okay.
Get your definitions clear first, then we can discuss it.
Okay.
Yes, Valerie. Valerie has all her ideas. She's got her own special religion, I think. Valerie's unique. She's a Valerieist. What do you want to say, Valerie?
I don't understand why you can't accept that death and time is not part of I.
You need to look into it. I need you, because it's not... I will tell you why, because I have different definitions. It's very simple.
No, I don't
Excuse
think
me,
so.
Valerie, listen to me. Let's say you've learned geometry, and you would agree, according to geometry, this table is flat. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And let's say that's what you think flat means. You accept?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I tell you about when you play music, you play B flat.
Yeah.
You've heard of music and it says B flat.
Yeah.
Now you know you've got to change your mind and have a different definition for the use of the word there, don't you? You know there can be two definitions for the same word. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
You have a definition of death and time. I'm telling you, Buddha's definition is different. So you have to accept that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to agree with my definition. So I don't accept your definition. It's very simple, but you're allowed to have it. My definition of death, according to Buddha, is when the mind and a body separate. Buddha's definition of time is the passing of moments from present, past, present, and future.
Mm.
That's the definition of those phenomena. Mm. You don't need to accept that, but you can accept your view very comfortably.
I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I'm trying to understand what my view is. So
that well, that's your job, not mine, babe. I wish you well. I wish you well. Keep moving. You're doing great, Valerie.
Can I just ask you? So maybe I'm trying to, you know, it's interesting because last night I had this really very, very strong wish of death.
Meaning you want to die?
Yes.
Okay, a strong, I want to die, you
yes.
thought. So then what did you do about it? You obviously didn't carry it through. You're still here.
Well, I fell asleep, so thank
oh,
God.
Oh, just as well. Good, I'm glad you woke up. I'm happy to see you again, Valerie. Keep trucking. Then?
No, I'm just... And I realise that I have this delusion...
Yes.
...that I'm trying to. I don't want to be born, and I want to escape.
Good. That sounds like good. Buddha would say that's called renunciation. You're sick of suffering. So you, what he would say is, you better find out what suffering is. Get your definitions clear. Okay. Find out what the causes are, and stop doing the causes, and then you'll get the result. And he says the causes of suffering are delusions. So you better find out what the delusions are and stop having them, and then you'll stop being born and you'll have bliss.
Okay.
Good luck. All right? Okay. We didn't finish Tara, so we'll leave her suspended over the building, and suspended in the air, all blissful, watching us, enjoying us eating our lunch. And so we think of lunch as this delicious nectar. Don't believe in your karmic appearances. Don't believe in it's boring old peas and rice again, or bread, and I don't like that, and I do like that. That's just your karmic appearance. That's just your delusions talking. So we turn it into blissful nectar. We imagine it's divine, blissful nectar, this delicious lunch. Blessed with the energy of all the Buddhas, Om Ah Hung, Om Ah Hung, Om Ah Hung. We think of it as completely empty of existing from its own side, as this or that. We see it as transcendental, blissful nectar, as big as the universe. And then, as Lama Zopa says, the main thing is we offer it. So we just imagine all the Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas and all the suffering mother sentient beings. We imagine if we could, we would offer to them all of it. And then, finally, as Lama Zopa says, according to Tantra, the very meaning of the word offering or chur or puja is to see the recipients, in this case all these beings, experiencing the joy of receiving this delicious food, which we so happily offer. And then, of course, we think we're going to eat it so we can be fat and healthy, so we can keep working on our mind, become a Buddha, to benefit all these suffering sentient beings. And then just those thoughts, about 45 seconds of thoughts, so many seeds you planted in your mind, it's inconceivable, the virtue of this. And as Rinpoche says, once you've thought this way, the bigger your stomach, the better. So please go and stuff yourself with bliss, and then have your discussions. So we're finishing at the same time, 5 o'clock? Yes. Okay. So yesterday's timing was about right? 2 hour and a half was fine? Too long? Too short? Was about too short to have your lunch? Oh dear. Too long? So you finish your lunch earlier than 2 o'clock? Well, you can come back soon if you like, and we've got a lot to talk about. Okay, so come back here at an hour's enough? Try an hour, but then see how it goes. Don't get constipation or the other one, indigestion, sorry. So I'll see you in about an hour and something, okay? Okay.